Hello, welcome to Values, Virtues, Ethics and Morality. My name is Magla Pillay and I have here today in the studio with me Sister Denise, who's been practicing Raja Yoga meditation with the Brahma Kumaris for several decades. The topic that we're going to take up today has to do with the title, in that we're concerned in the show with conventional morality. And by that I mean we would like you to examine your own ethics, your own morals, your own set of personal standards, and to ask yourself the simple question is, does all of that work for you today? Is there a conflict between what you think, your attitudes, your own personal standards, and what you do? And we are aware that most people, or people in general rather, would like to think that in every situation they do the right thing, but paradoxically, we find that people act against their conscience, and we want to look at why this is the case. So today we have in the studio with us Sister Denise, who will share with us her thoughts on the subject of social contract, which has to do with our title, and how this impacts on human conduct. Sister Denise, very warm welcome to today's show.
Thank you very much.
And thank you so much for being here. Could you tell us something about this topic? It's a very curious topic, and it's not something that I would have linked to the title of the show.
Well, it is connected, because every relationship is a contract. In fact, if you think of the expression marriage, it's a contract of marriage. So there is an agreement between one family and another family, and so you have a boy and a girl who get married for the purpose of the perpetuation of the species, basically. But every relationship there is, even including if you are a child of a mother and father, just by giving birth to you, they enter into a contract, and you also are contractually obliged to them. And it's quite important to take a look at the nature of this social contract. Take it to a wider basis, the contract that exists between the governing or ruling class and the ruled, in the case of, say, a kingdom, where you have a democratic system, you have representatives who represent the people, who are given powers, and they have to fulfill their contractual obligation to the people. But the problem is, people are losing contact internally with this contract, because it's not a written contract. And sometimes it's a good idea to write it down. And even there is a contract or a contractual relationship between people and God. There's a contract between people and the earth. And the problem, the human problems arise because we do not understand our contract and we do not fulfill our contractual obligations. So because this is become forgotten, unknown, we experience consequences of having violated a contract that we don't even know we entered into, and because of that also we don't know how to rectify the problems.
So all the social problems that we see in the world has commenced or erupted as a result of people not fulfilling their obligations towards each other? Is that what you say?
I don't think it's erupted, but I think that it slowly occurred over time. Initially, at some point, the contract was intuitively felt and understood, but that intuition has become eroded. The contract has been violated and forgotten slowly over time, and now it's hardly even spoken of and definitely fully forgotten. So we need to look at what is the nature of that contract. the contract between a parent and a child, for example, is that the parent is obligated to feed, to clothe, to care for, to guide, to arrange for education, learning, personal development of that child. When that child reaches a certain age, the obligations change, and the child and the parents have a more equal role, and they cooperate with each other as adults. When the parents become old, then the child has an obligation to care for the parents, to give the return for the care that the parents gave that child during the years as the child was growing up. Now, if the parent doesn't take care of the child, but still expects the child to take care of the parent when they are old, it's not going to work out, because the child will not feel any obligation to take care, because there's no feeling of having been cared for, you see. So it comes to a feeling, and because it's on a feeling level, it's often not written down, it's not talked about. Now, the contract between the governing class in a country and the governed people is that the governing ones have an obligation to protect, to provide an infrastructure, to provide the food, the employment, all this. And the people have an obligation to enrich the country. So it needs to be a balanced contract. But as soon as there's an imbalance and one section of the population takes advantage of the other section, then the contract is null and void, and then it results in conflict, you see. So we have a lot of conflict in the world because of the voiding of the social contract due to the responsibilities not being fulfilled. And so I think it's very valuable to bring up this idea of a social contract so that people can see and ask themselves the question, what are my rights? What are my obligations?
If one finds oneself in the position where you extremely unhappy in a relationship, is it possible to renegotiate the contract, or do you say, I'm tired of this, let me up and leave?
A good relationship is fraught with difficulties, and the circumstances of the relationship change from time to time. Every time something comes up, you need to renegotiate the relationship. So it's a continuous process of renegotiation. If you don't do that, you will have a bad relationship, mostly because you haven't negotiated it. So I think one of the important elements of education needs to be, how do you negotiate your relationships? Because people have no idea.
No, I agree with you in that sense. So how then would you define success in such a contract, in such a situation?
Success is where a person has an intuitive feeling of what their rights and responsibilities are. But in order to arrive at that intuitive feeling, you may need to move across some confusion about it, because if you don't know, it needs to be spelled out. And so I think one of the important factors included in a spiritual education is that it does start getting spelled out, and then you need to think about it and really work out, okay, what are the rights and responsibilities in the roles that I play in my life, you see. Because we have relationships with various people, not just one or two people, lots of different people. And each relationship has a different contract, different rights, different responsibilities are involved. You know, you create relationships as you go along. If you walk along a path and you meet somebody regularly every day, you say hello to them, they say hello to you, you've created a contract. And if one day you walk by them and look the other way, you've broken that contract. You see? Because you have set a pattern that when I meet you, I salute you, I recognize you as my fellow human being, our contract is a very slight friendliness, and that's the nature of that relationship.
How come this is so unknown? Why is this news to most people, what you just said? Why is something that's so important so unspoken?
Well, I think there are some assumptions that are made. I remember discussing with someone his relationship with his daughter, and I said, you know, you need to be much more active in your relationship with her, because, you know, she really doesn't know certain things that you have an obligation to be teaching to her. And he said to me, oh well, it should be automatic, she should just know automatically. I said, no, it doesn't work like that. So I think there are these assumptions that, you know, a mother automatically knows how to care for a child. Not at all. You know, a father automatically knows how to look after a family. No. You know, there are good ways to do it which can be known, and they need to be actually spelled out, because then a person will know if I've got it right or I haven't. You know, just like you learn reading, writing and arithmetic, you need these in life, you need these other things as well.
The scenarios that you just explained, where one has to continually renegotiate the contract, it seems that one, before you even speak, you need to know that you have a voice.
Yes.
Yes. And before you even get to knowing the fact that you have a voice, means that you have to have a shred of self-worth. Now, from what you just said, I think the reason that there are so many voiceless people in a two-contract relationship where there's only one party with the voice is because the other party does not know that they have a voice and does not have the self-worth to develop a voice. How does one get there? Because there are a number of men and women who, within the context of a relationship, are disenfranchised.
Very much so. And I think it is because of the conventional morality, which says that, you know, children should be seen and not heard. So right there, you don't have a voice. Then you get another expression, another message, boys have a right to education, girls don't. So you don't need to be educated, you don't need to earn an income, you are just for the purpose of reproducing, tidying up and cooking. So this message is given to a lot of girls, and a lot of boys are given another very difficult message: you are obligated to pay for all of us, you have to work, and we will be supported by you. And that could be unlimited, you know, it's a tremendous burden is given. And that boy doesn't have any reference point for saying, no, I'm not obligated to do this, because they will train him to think that he is. And so this is why I think that there needs to be an external agency to compensate for all of these messages that have come through the ages, through the traditions, which have really misinformed or contributed to the disenfranchisement of people. And so perhaps a program like this can be useful to clarify these, and these are your rights as a human being. You know, I used to ask people, Have you read the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights? Do you know what your rights are as a human being? You know, this was written up by Eleanor Roosevelt during the 30s, 40s, and was a very important part of the establishment of the United Nations. Mm. Very few people have read that. It's a very good document because it states very clearly what your rights are. You know, you have a right to employment. You have a right to not be forced into marriage under the age of 18. You know, all of these have been clearly written out, and I think that this needs to be part of the school curriculum so that people understand what a human being is, what a human being's rights are, and then they have some equipment, as it were, intellectual equipment with which to negotiate their position in a society, even if that society is dysfunctional or unbalanced.
If somebody is not happy with their contract, okay, you said that they've got to renegotiate it, the person that they're in contract with, but what if there are certain people who are forced into a contract? How do they get out of it?
I think the first thing is to be able to articulate what you feel your rights are. And when a person is unhappy and uncomfortable, it's an indication that the relationship is unbalanced, karmically. Because karma, the laws of karma say that the give and take between people needs to be pretty much equal. And if somebody's giving a lot and somebody else is taking a lot, it becomes unequal. At a certain point, pain sets in, which is a messenger to say that this arrangement is not right. And so then the person is alerted by their pain to say, you need to renegotiate your contract. Mm. You know, and the contract may be, you know, you have to do what I say and you have no rights, and the person has to say no.
Mr. Denise, you find that there are a number of people who are deeply unhappy in every single relationship they have, in every single relationship that they are involved in. Okay, and it has been said then, look at the common denominator, you don't have a problem, you are the problem. What would you say to such a person? Does the problem then lie in the contract, or does the problem lie in the contractor or T?
It would be important to talk to that person and ask them what their thinking is. Because I think the problem would be in their thinking, in their assumptions. It has to be to do with what they have been led to believe or what they have figured out, you know, because there has to be some logical incoherence and inconsistency in their thinking, and that needs to be pointed out.
Mm. Okay, we've thus far spoken about a social contract with human beings. Is God in a contractual relationship with humanity?
Yes.
And what kind of contract is that?
The contract of God to humanity is that God will be present for people who love God. And when there is no love for God, when there is antagonism against God, then that presence is broken, and then the person can no longer experience cooperation and sustenance from God.
What are the criteria to be eligible as a contracting party with God?
Probably the thing is the attitude.
Okay. What I'm thinking of is in every cell phone contract one signs nowadays, the bottom, not just a cell phone contract, most contracts, it says terms and conditions apply. So my question to you is, what terms and conditions apply to a soul vis-a-vis God?
The problem for most people is they do not know God, they do not know anything about God, and because of that, in a way, they're excused from doing wrong things out of ignorance. But once you start to know, then you are no longer in ignorance. So if you go against the contract, you will pay a much heavier price than if you go against the contract because you do not know. So there is that difference.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember when I was in some countries which previously had been in communism, and communist rule had finished, and so the people said to me, well, we were raised to be atheists, which was a very interesting statement because it indicated that they were intuitively not atheists. Communism in Russia went for about 70 years or something. So the very, very old people, older than 70 years, would sort of secretly pass on a few thoughts about God. And so it was kind of known, but underground. And when people came out of that system where any kind of spirituality or religion was forbidden, but they had the intuition, they had the instinct for it, and it became very easy to reconnect that relationship. So I think that the essential, original contract is when a soul has an encounter with God, which happens at some point in time for every single soul, which leaves an indelible mark on the soul that enables that soul to recognize that there is something going on. And it takes the form of a person believes in God or by some other name, and there is an intuitive sort of sense of gratitude, love, an awareness. You know, we have expressions, God knows, so we say that. God rewards and punishes, people think like that. And so something to do with the way in which a person conducts themselves, in their behavior, in their sense of value of their self, in the sense of caring for the earth, in the sense of operating something like from this initial state of purity, peace, love, bliss, happiness, power. And of course it's not clearly known, but it's intuitively felt. Now if a person is operating with that, they're going to be all right with God. But if a person hates God or goes against God, then you have to see, well, what are the reasons for that? What triggered that? You know, because there has to be some sort of trauma somewhere where maybe they had a problem with a religion, or they had a problem in some other way which made them feel that, well, there is no God, you know, and so they feel abandoned, they feel, so they interpret things in that way. But at the bottom of the heart, there will be something which can reconnect with God when they recognize that, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And then that restores the contract.
Okay, so above and beyond recognition, what does one do to open the gates, as it were, between the soul and God? Because it's not just a question of recognition, it has to be more, you have to take it further, as they say in our world, you have to take it to the next level. So how does one take one's relationship to God to the next level?
Giving importance to truth, giving importance to kindness, giving importance to generosity, to love, to care, because all of these are virtues of God, and every human being is endowed with those, and every time you express those divine virtues, you are doing something to fulfill your contract with God. Mm-hmm. And then the reciprocation from God is that you will receive something. Because a contract is all about reciprocity.
Mm. Mm.
So if you break the contract, then you don't get what the contract is about getting.
Mm. Okay. Yes, unfortunately, I think that's all for today. We wish we can take this conversation further, but I suppose on someday, one of the topics will be just about God. Nothing else but God. So Sister Denise has shared her thoughts on an extremely fascinating subject called social contract. I must say, Sister Denise, I didn't see it the way you just put it. It's a very refreshing stance or viewpoint on something that all of us take for granted. So there you have it. I hope that you are able to look at your relationships with every single person that is in your life and ask yourself whether your relationships are balanced, whether they are in a state of equilibrium, and whether you're getting something out of it as well as giving something into it. So I hope that Sister Denise's words has inspired you to also renegotiate your own relationship with God, whatever it may be and whichever religion you may belong to. So thank you so much for your time, and we do hope to see you again. Take care and goodbye.